hello again, everyone. It is the first Thursday of March, Thursday, March the 3rd. It is noon Eastern time, which means it is time for another Access to Access webinar. With all of the crazy headlines that are passing every single day, whether they have to do with negative interest rates, the elimination of cash, whether Great Britain, England should leave the European Union, all that stuff going on, I thought, man, what a perfect time to bring back our good buddy Alistair MacLeod. If you, you're probably familiar with Alistair, but if you're not, he is the head of research at goldmoney.com. He also runs his wonderful site for himself, financeandeconomics.org. You can find his research pieces posted to both. And I'm happy to pronounce him a good friend of Turdville. So, Alistair, thank you so much for spending some time with us today.
It's very much my pleasure. Thanks very much indeed, Craig.
Alistair, it has been a very interesting 2016 so far. And before we got started this morning, you were sharing a few thoughts on today's price action of gold. We're moving up. I'm praying it's not a double top. We've seen a high so far today of 1261. The high back on February the 11th was 1263. But you're a bit of a technician yourself. You've noticed a few happy things on the chart. Share everybody at least a little optimistic viewpoint today, would you please?
Yes, I think like most people following the gold story, when it's looking good on the charts, I talk about the charts. And this is certainly a situation which is very good on the charts, because you have got the 200-day moving average and the 55-day moving average now both moving up, having gone through a golden cross with the price above it. And furthermore, the price has completed a flag pattern, which if you dust down your old copy of Edwards and McGee will tell you that it marks the halfway point in a rapid rise. So if that is right, within the next month or two, we should be seeing the price of gold moving towards 1400. If it doesn't happen, then I think we can probably tear up our Edwards and McGee and think again. But I will go with that for the moment. I'm quite happy to go with that.
It'll be very interesting to see. Here in Turdville, we're worried about the effect of the BLSBS, the non-farm payrolls tomorrow. That it kind of setting the tone as we move toward the FOMC, which will be 1 week from next Wednesday, will be the conclusion of that. I just can't imagine that the Fed's going to try to raise rates again, but we'll see.
Well, I think, yes, I mean, I think you're right. Raising the rates was, in central banking terms anyway, in December, was a mistake. I mean, I'm not going to say where the rate should be, because actually only the market can tell us where the rate should be. And the fact that the central banks sort of seem to think they know where it should be, I don't think I should follow suit and buck the markets. You know, it is clear that the global economy is in a degree of trouble, because we have seen a contraction of global trade, and quite a severe contraction of global trade.
Yep.
And that tells me that the outlook isn't all that rosy for any economy. So on that basis, if the Fed was thinking of raising interest rates because it sees full employment, the economy is chugging along quite nicely and all the rest of it, global trade is telling us that that actually is not correct. Now, insofar as that begins to impact on the central bank's monetary policy, then I think we can defer any thoughts of interest rate rises. And what that then does is it weakens the dollar. And I think this is the key to it. If you have a weak dollar, you have strong gold. And that's basically, I think, what's happened. Suddenly there's been this realization that the dollar is peaking out against commodities. It's difficult to measure it against currencies, because I'd like to come on to the euro in a moment, perhaps, when we talk about the European scene and Brexit and so on. But if you just look at the dollar against commodities, you can see that it's turning a corner, it's peaking out. And I think gold is sending almost an advanced signal of that. And it's very, very important to understand it that way around, rather than just looking at gold and thinking the dollar is a constant, it's the gold price that's going up. No, what's actually happening is the dollar's going down.
Right, right. And that's a very wise way to look at it. You know, if we were to get the completion of that technical pattern you're talking about, that would probably be what would drive it. You know, some maybe surprise announcement or something out of the FOMC in 10 days. But I do want to move on, Alistair. And for everybody listening, the format of this, I usually have a couple questions for the guest first, and I've got a couple lined up for my buddy Alistair. I've got a couple that were emailed in. We'll get to those first. But if you would like to ask Alistair anything, this is your chance. On your GoToWebinar control panel, there is a questions tab. You click that questions tab. You type in whatever question you want. When we get to that part of the show, I relay that question to Alistair. But Alistair, first up is my own question. Living in England, as you are, you're a very close observer of everything that's going on there regarding, I just think this term is a lousy term, but Brexit. The idea that Great Britain might leave the European Union. You just wrote about it today. We'll link that new post into this podcast page for everybody can see it. But we're a couple months out, and it's going to be, you know, opinions are going to be swayed one way or the other by the time we get to this vote. But what do you think of this notion at this point? And what would the impact be if the vote was, yeah, let's do it?
Well, in my note, I'm very careful not to take sides in this, but to try and look at it dispassionately and objectively. What I would draw to everyone's attention is that in this country, we usually do not have prolonged campaigns ahead of a referendum or ahead of an election or whatever. Usually these things happen quite quickly. So for us, even though June the 23rd is the first possible date that we could have this referendum, it is actually quite a long time. Now, the reason that matters is that the government stance on this, or at least the government members who want to stay in the EU, is really to push a negative story. They're saying, on the one hand, you know, if you go outside the EU, all our trade agreements fall apart. If we go outside the EU, we won't have the intelligence links which are necessary to keep this country safe. You know, it's all this negativity. You know, we've got to stay in there because it's cold outside. Now, and they keep on coming up with scare stories basically to reinforce that. Now, the trouble is that negative referendum campaigns basically do not work. You have to have something positive to energize the electorate to vote the way you want. And I think this is a fundamental flaw,
right,
which so far people just don't haven't actually taken on board. But if you talk to any you know, sort of individual who is an expert in reading opinion polls and maybe even producing opinion polls and so on and so forth, they will agree that the worst sort of thing you can do is have a prolonged negative campaign. Because after a while, people stop believing you. It's actually, that's probably the best way to put it. By contrast, of course, the people who would want us to leave actually can come up with a positive story. Because if we, you know, the positive story is quite simple. The European Union is full of risk and is dying. And is on a model which is no longer relevant. If we leave them and concentrate on the rest of the world, we've got the whole of Asia, we've got, you know, we've got developing Africa. I mean, however you want to spin the story, there are far better growth prospects in economies outside the EU, which actually we should be targeting towards. I don't actually like the idea of governments and people saying that, you know, the policy should be that we move in this direction or that direction, being a libertarian. But you can see that from the point of view of a campaign, a referendum campaign, that what we will get is a more positive story from the outers than the stay-inners. So it is quite likely that this is going to begin to drift away from, if you like, the sort of the planned outcome that David Cameron set forth. The other thing I would say is that there is an awful lot of risk in the European banking system, and particularly the Eurozone banking system. Mm-hmm. We've had the Italian banks on, you know, they're on life support. The Portuguese banks are on life support. The Greek banks are on life support. The Eurozone bond markets, I mean, something like 40% of them are on negative yields. I mean, this is just, take it as, if you like, an indication as how overvalued Eurozone bonds, government bonds, sovereign bonds are. They are wildly overvalued. Now, that is a crash waiting to happen. All I can say is that we must hope, from the point of view of staying in the Eurozone, we must hope that the crash doesn't happen, or there isn't a significant deterioration in the outlook for the Eurozone over the next 2 or 3 months ahead of that referendum. So all in all, it's actually quite a risky situation. And the other thing that came out of the G20 meeting is that it's obviously understood by the finance ministers and by the central banks of the G20 that one of the big risks in 2016 is a Brexit. Now, you know, okay, we're the fifth largest economy in the world, but if Britain came out, that would actually create an international financial economic crisis. But what would create a crisis is the effect on the Eurozone.
Right.
And I think this is the important point, because if we come out, then the remainder of the European Union is going to have two problems. There are other people who are not happy, and they will feel that they're not committed to stay anymore. And secondly, the whole banking system is going to get exposed to that fracture that runs between Germany and Finland and Holland on one side, and Greece, Italy, Spain, France on the other side. So you can see that the risks that are actually in the Eurozone, if they're not, if they don't become apparent before a Brexit, they will certainly hit hard after Brexit. So I think this is one reason why governments are really almost terrified of the prospect of a Brexit, because they can see what the consequences will be.
Well, I tell you what, for everybody listening, I mean, you just heard Alistair discuss all that, and I'm sitting here thinking, oh my God, by June 23rd, anything could happen. Like you said, first people want to vote for something rather than against something. And it sounds like the whole advertising campaign and the promotion is going to be, you know, try to stay in the European Union. But gosh, by late June, who knows what the world will look like? Who knows what the migrant situation, everything else is in Europe?
Yes.
And boy, the impacts, like you said, on the euro right away, if not then as we go through the rest of this year, could just be extraordinary.
Yeah. Well, there is in my article, I point out that there is a potential escape route from this as far as Germany and Britain are concerned. And that is that the northern states effectively ditch the euro and join Britain in what I describe as a Hanseatic League. The original Hanseatic League goes back over 300 or 400 years, and it was basically a trading route which ran between England and the United Kingdom across the North Sea, mm-hmm. through the Baltic into Russia, and taking into account all those German states, if you like, which are sort of along the coast, as it were, along the way. So a Hanseatic League this time, I think, would include Germany, Holland, Britain, Finland, Poland, the Czech Republic, Slovakia. Those I can see as being the immediate members. And this is, so you would have, a Northern Bloc, which would then work on the basis of commerce rather than politics, and the Southern Bloc would be left in the cold. Now, if that happened, it really would be the end of the euro, and it would be absolute crisis for those southern countries. But if we have a Brexit, it is a solution as far as Britain is concerned, as far as Germany is concerned. So that sort of thing might get a momentum of its own. Very early days, and it's a speculative thought, but it's, I think, nonetheless an interesting possibility.
Well, I tell you, Alistair, we've talked, I can go back to when I started this site, I can go back to 2010, 2011, and we were talking about the idea of a northern euro and a southern euro, you know, a Nordic euro and the pigs. And all that kind of stuff, and how that seemed an eventuality. And there were always folks that, oh, no, the euro is always going to be the way it is, and all that kind of stuff. But boy, I mean, the writing could clearly be on the wall come late June. It's going to be interesting to watch.
You're right. You are right about that. I mean, basically, Germany got to the point, we are told, where she was almost going to issue her own currency.
Yeah.
but you know, they backed off. Germany's problem is she started two world wars, and she doesn't want to be responsible for breaking apart the European Union.
Yeah. Right?
Completely understandable. It is a political problem they have, rather than you know, leading to an economic problem. And the point I'm making, in effect, is that if Britain does decide to leave the European Union, then actually it would open the way for Germany to do a similar thing. Now, maybe not a complete Brexit, Grexit. Or, no, that's the Greek one, isn't it? German exit.
I got you, though.
Yeah, but you know, did you see what I mean? I mean, this actually could trigger a lot of unintended consequences.
Certainly could, and you know, you've already got Merkel kind of hanging on by her fingernails with all of the migrant stuff that's going on in Germany. Who knows how much worse that could be in 90 days? I mean, this whole thing could really feed on itself. And to that end, let me kind of steer that and connect that to the next thing I wanted to ask you about, and that's this growing global move to eliminate cash. I mean, it was kind of written about occasionally in 2015. You'd see articles maybe in Time magazine here in the States or something about, what do we need cash for anyway? You can pay for things with your iPhone if you want. But now it's really picking up steam. And in the face of the imposition of negative interest rates, and then I'm sitting here listening to you thinking about capital controls, man, you can almost see this coming, can't you, Alistair?
Yes, certainly. I mean, this story about banning cash or doing away with cash really started with an article by the chief economist at the Bank of England, a guy called Andy Haldane. Now, Andy Haldane wrote quite a long article about negative interest rates. And in that article, he basically said the only way you can make negative interest rates stick is to ban cash, because otherwise people would move out of negative yielding deposits into, you know, cash, which which can't yield you nothing, as it were. Of course, you know, the central banks for some time have wanted to reduce the element of cash in the economy simply because it gives them greater control over the banking system. You know, if you decide that you don't like Bank A, you take your money out and you can't put it into cash anymore. You can't just go along and sort of knock on the till and say, I want to withdraw all my money in cash.
Right.
You merely transfer it to another bank. And so long as people do that, then, you know, deposits get recycled through the money market with or without the central bank's help. And no bank is going to fall over from a run against it. And that's the point. That's really why the central banks don't like cash. It does create the possibility of an old-fashioned run on a bank.
Yep.
So, you know, it's really, I think, for those two reasons. And then, of course, you get, all the other reasons are trotted out, like, you know, it's used by criminals for laundering money, etc., etc. It's used for tax evasion. You know, anyone who wants to produce a story against cash always trots out those things.
Yep.
Now, of course, you do away with cash. I mean, is that going to stop money laundering? Is that going to stop tax evasion? No. I mean, you know, it's just complete. The whole thing is a complete nonsense. But the point is that I think at a time of monetary risk, when the banking system as a whole, I mean, the American banking system is better off than most because they've actually made some attempt to recapitalize. The Europeans have made no attempt to recapitalize. They've improved their balance sheets just by buying overpriced government debt, because the Basel III regulations say you don't have to take a haircut on it. You know, I mean, that is not a substitute for a decent capital base in the bank. The result is the banks are horrendously overgeared. You know, I mean, when you see that the average ratio of bank capital, shareholder capital, to the size of their balance sheets is something like 1/20th. In other words, only 4%, you know, sort of, you've got a figure like 4% is the average level of capital to liabilities through the Eurozone banking system. Now, if that is the average, then there are going to be some which are worse off than that. You just better hope it's not your bank. And so, you know, with that background, you can see why central banks are quite keen to do away with things which might just collapse the system. One of which is cash.
Yep. And again, it augurs toward owning physical metal, no doubt about that. Alistair, I want to move on. I've got two questions that were emailed to me. that I want to lay upon you first. And then it looks like I've already got five or six in queue. Again, if there's anything you'd like me to follow up on with Alistair, if you have a question of your own, just type it into the questions tab and we'll get there. Alistair, first up, this one comes from a regular contributor here on our A to A presentations. His name is Gaz. And here's Gaz's question. In the Gold Money 2016 Outlook with Mr. Turk and with John Butler, you seemed very certain that negative interest rates for the U.S. dollar would put all commodities into immediate backwardation and that negative interest rates would be the most effective and rapid way to stabilize commodity prices. So Gary's question, I don't know if it's Gary or not. Gary, well, it might be. If negative rates were to become a reality, could that be a time when silver could significantly outperform gold as it's both a monetary and industrial commodity? Or is silver's dual role of no consequence?
Very good question. Basically, Gaz, what I said in that interview was that if you get negative interest rates in the dollar, then it puts all commodities into a natural state of backwardation. Basically, for the very simple reason that if you're going to be taxed on your deposit, then that, if you like, is makes the deposit worth less than you actually owning physical copper, gold, silver, whatever it might be. So that is, if you like, a natural state of backwardation, which presumably would tail off as you go out along the time curve. As far as silver is concerned, yes, I mean, it would drive the price of silver up. But I think in the very short term, what I would expect is that gold's run has actually caught the establishment incredibly by surprise. Nobody was really expecting this at all. In fact, if you look at all the prognostications that have come out of the big investment banks, you know, they've all been talking it down to the 1,000, maybe 950 type level. And yet here we are, we've suddenly shot up from, what, 1048, something like that in December? And we're currently trading at 1255. These guys have got it so wrong. So what they're now waiting for is for the price to come back a bit, and then they're going to buy it again. That's what they're hoping, or close their bears, or whatever the position is. When they find it doesn't come back, they then start looking for an alternative, because they'll feel they've missed the boat in gold. They will understand that gold is now in a bull market. So how do you play it? Well, the answer is quite simple. Silver's got left behind, so we better have some of that. And I think that, so... If the technical thing about a flag is right and gold starts running again from here, it's very overbought, by the way, and we're talking about a situation that's going to get even more overbought. If that happens, then silver, I think, will be the one that would really begin to catch up because it has been left behind. I mean, the silver-gold ratio is what? It's about 82 or something. I mean, this is silver is ridiculously undervalued and has been left behind.
We might get to that in the final four as well. But before we get there... I've got my second emailed question for you, Alistair. This one comes from Lyndon, and it's a long question. I have no idea how to try to compress this, so hang in there with me.
Right. Go ahead.
It says, if we are indeed at an early stage of a gold bull market, with the bullion bank cartel suppression of gold prices nearing its end and gold about to rise back to its old highs, will a higher gold price preclude negative interest rate policy, NERP? Gibson's paradox would seem to suggest that the Federal Reserve would not be able to do NERP with gold at, say, $2,400 an ounce. However, does Gibson's paradox only apply to a free market system and not a manipulated market where governments are buying each other's debt? And finally, is Gibson's paradox failing in this manipulated world? For example, Canada probably has a very low interest rate, yet gold price is near all-time highs. And price inflation is already rearing its ugly head in Canada. So could we still have negative interest rates even if the gold price goes up to its old high or exceeds it?
Right. I think that's probably the thing to concentrate on to start with, and then I'll try and make some comments about Gibson's paradox.
Fair enough.
I think that the answer is that if gold goes up to the old highs, you will also find that other commodities will also be rising. And this goes back to what I said earlier. Really, what we are likely to see in the coming months and maybe years is a falling dollar. And that is the common theme to the whole thing. Yep. So if you look at it from the point of view of the dollar's going down rather than gold is going up, then that, I think, answers the question. If the dollar is going down like that, then yes, it must preclude NERP. NERP cannot happen when that happens, because all that would happen if you put NERP on top of that situation, you would immediately create, or relatively immediately create, hyperinflation. In other words, a collapse of the purchasing power of the currency. So it follows that if gold continues this run, then the likelihood of NERP, and I think it's a very good point you're bringing out here, the likelihood of NERP recedes. Not only that, but if we do get back to those old highs, I think you can forget NERP. What you're likely to have is rising dollar interest rates, rising interest rates in the other fiat currencies as well, because they're all equally affected. But where they will get it wrong is they will raise the rates reluctantly and too slowly. And the reason they will do that is that the central banks and the politicians are going to be desperately worried about the bankruptcies from higher nominal interest rates.
Well, yeah,
and this is the whole point.
Well, Alistair, I have to ask you about this, because they really can't raise rates. You talked about these European banks that own all these bonds at 0% or less. It would threaten their solvency, their liquidity. Is it even possible to raise rates? Isn't NERP almost a fait accompli?
Well, not NERP as such, but what is a fait accompli, if you like, in a sense, is that we're all stuck in a debt trap.
Right.
And if you raise nominal interest rates, then basically you face your maker. I mean, it's as simple as that.
Yeah.
And that is going to be the next dilemma that the central banks face, because as the purchasing power of the dollar goes down, or put another way, price inflation starts rising, at that stage, obviously what they will have to do is put up interest rates. But if you put up interest rates and you start bankrupting businesses, mm-hmm. you start creating another homeowners crisis with mortgage rates, which nobody can afford. And worse than that, the government itself, suddenly all its finances become completely untenable. Then obviously, I mean, what does the central bank do?
Right.
They're really between, between a rock and a hard place.
Yes.
And there is no escape. So this is a situation which Volcker dealt with in 1980, 1981. But I don't really see that option is open this time, unfortunately.
Exactly.
I mean, Volcker broke the savings and loan business and all the rest of it. He did enough damage, if you like, conquering price inflation at that stage. It had to be done. But this time round, I mean, for goodness sake, how far does it go?
Yeah.
So anyway, that is my view. Coming on to Gibson's paradox,
yes,
it is basically a free market phenomenon, because really what happens is that the only thing that an investing businessman knows is what the prices of today are. He might have a forecast as what it's going to be tomorrow and so on and so forth, or in the year's time or 2 years' time, but always he bases it on the known price today. And this is the point that all the other economists seem to have missed. It means that when it comes to borrowing in order to invest in new production or new products, because today's price is the only thing he knows, the amount of interest that he is prepared to pay in order to set about that production, set about that investment, is obviously geared to the prices of today. So that is why interest rates in a free market basically follow the price level and do not follow the level of inflation. And that is, put simplistically, is the answer. We have a situation today where Gibson's paradox is not applying, for the very simple reason that the central banks are now controlling interest rates completely and redirecting, when they can, bank credit towards investment. So companies are being almost told to invest, which in a sense is taking away the role of the market. I mean, the whole thing is a sort of a planned nightmare, which is designed to do away with the risks that macroeconomists see markets bringing about into the economy. So I think I think what Gibson's paradox tells us is that it's no longer applying, and if it's no longer applying, then the markets are so corrupted they are under no stretch of the imagination free.
Right, right.
But we do know that eventually free markets do return, and that's the thing to watch out for. And I think the rise in the price of gold is perhaps telling us, you know, hold on, the risk, if you like, to the centrally planned outcome that the bankers and the politicians really, really desire, the risk to that is getting rather high. And I would certainly see that this dilemma over interest rates, that's the next big, big thing. What do you do with interest rates when price inflation is raging? How on earth can you put them up and not bankrupt everybody?
Yeah, yeah. Well, and that's an excellent segue to the first listener question. And I want to stop here for a second and thank you for your time, Alistair. We're already a half hour into this, and you're just being very generous again with your time, and it's greatly, greatly appreciated. I know everybody's learning a lot listening to you, and you're providing a lot of insight and making us think. This first question that has been sent in by a listener comes from Arthur. And he wonders if you can address what other people have said. I don't know if you've ever said this, but can you address what other people have said about silver being a possible Achilles heel of the banking system? In other words, it seems as if silver is under really steep price suppression. And if I might add to Arthur's comment, you know, we follow the commitment of traders info here pretty closely. And in this move from 14 to 15 and change, the move by the banks, primarily JP Morgan, to go net short to the largest position they've had net short since 2008. So so get back to Arthur's question. Why is silver under such suppression? Is it really, is it just a function of money perhaps, you know, and defending a already short position? Or do you think it really is some type of Achilles heel to the system?
I think silver is not really regarded, I think, by industry, by even the mining industry, the silver mining industry, for which a lot of them, silver is just a byproduct of what they do. It's not regarded as a monetary metal anymore. It's regarded as an industrial metal. I think that this sets the scene in a way, because the one thing I have discovered is that the way silver miners work is that they will have their output assayed by someone like Glencore or Trafigura, one of those sort of big specialists. They will come up with a value, let's say, for a container load of Dory, and they will arrange with the bank, the finance, because obviously the silver mine is going to need to pay people, and they like to pay them up. They're always short of cash, so they need the money up front. So this is where JP Morgan comes in as a bank. You've got Trafigura setting up the deal to process the stuff. They ship it to China because China is the cheapest place to do it. This is assuming that you're on the Pacific seaboard anyway. I mean, there may be other places they send it to, like Poland if you're on the Atlantic seaboard. The result is that that goes to China. That then feeds the market for solar panels, which China is the largest manufacturer, various other industrial applications. And the interest, I think, of the parties other than the mine itself is to see a low price. So really, the role of JP Morgan, I'm just taking these names as a for instance in this. I have no special knowledge as to who actually is doing this. But what I do know is that you have to have a bank to do the finance, and how they cover themselves in the markets is, of course, another question. And you need to have someone like a Trafigura or a Glencore to actually sort of value the stuff on site and to arrange for its shipment and to find a processor. So it's quite a sort of it's a system which works as far as the players are concerned, but that does absolutely nothing for the price of silver. Now, as to getting more into Arthur's question, where the risk in all this lies, what we don't know is whether someone like a JP Morgan is actually covering the risk in the futures market, or indeed whether they are working, let us say, with a major consumer of silver, like the Chinese government, and controlling the price on that basis.
Right.
We really don't know. I mean, it certainly smells to me like a market which, the positions are too large, really, for the deliverable situation, for the liquidity in the market. We only know part of the story. We only know what appears in COMEX. We don't know what happens on over-the-counter derivatives, which are a larger part of the story, I have to say, than what we see. So we cannot actually work out the full liquidity in the situation. But the one thing we do know is that silver, if you like, is, call it the poor man's money, compared with gold. I mean, at an 80th of the price, you sort of feel that, you're not going to go and buy a meal with a gold coin, but you are going to go and buy a meal with a silver coin. So actually, this is why I think if the price of gold starts rising and people start thinking again that fiat money is in trouble, then yes, there is a role for silver, and by goodness, it's got a lot of catching up to do. But the interesting thing in this is that the amount of likely demand, once the general public in the world get the idea that silver actually is a sensible form of money compared with paper money, then actually the price of silver, I think, could get back to that gold silver ratio of 15.5 to 1, which was Isaac Newton's level. I wouldn't quite say that, but we could get back to somewhere between 20 and 30, which does imply that the price of silver is going to rise very, very rapidly once the systemic issues surrounding paper currency begin to be appreciated by the general public. So it's a second effect, if you like, from this new bull market in gold. I'm going to call this a new bull market in gold. It is a secondary effect. And this is why I think that after this little consolidation we've seen around about the 1230 to 1250 level, if we do run on over 1300, my goodness, the boys are going to go for silver. They must do, because it's been left behind.
Yeah, it's just barely above its own 200-day moving average. Alistair, the next question comes from Edward, who just wants to get your opinion on negative bond rates, not necessarily the negative interest rate policy, but just that so much of the industrialized globe, if you will, now has negative interest rates. Japan earlier this week priced 10-year bonds with a negative yield at auction. And Edward's question is, who the hell's buying these things?
Edward, your question is the right one to ask. I'll tell you who's buying it. Basically, it's banks. And the reason that banks buy it is that under the Basel III regulations, a bank can own a government bond without having to take any haircut whatsoever. So what the bank is looking at is, if the central bank is charging negative interest rates, as it were, then they can fund a negative yield on a government bond. And the fact that it's going out in Japan to 10 years just shows how ridiculous that situation has become.
Yeah.
I think the thing to bear in mind, I mean, it's the bird in the hand is worth two in a bush. I mean, basically, the way money works when you lend money, it's very, very simple. Possession of the money, physical possession of the money, is worth more than lending it out to someone who promises to give it back to you at a later date.
Yeah.
And this is why I say it's the bird in the hand is worth two in the bush. I mean, that is a simple fact of life. What the central banks have done is they have stood this whole natural relationship on its head. And because it is unnatural, at some stage the market is going to come back with a vengeance. And really, I think, bankrupt anyone who's got themselves into this ridiculous situation. I mean, imagine, think about the banks. I was referring to the Eurozone banks having a cover of, an average of about 4% capital to outstanding debt. Okay, let's assume that something that bond markets in the Eurozone return to some sort of normality. I mean, that would imply that the average bond price might fall 20%, 10%, 20%, something like that.
Yep.
I'm talking about the price, not the yield.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
I mean, I'm just talking about yields getting back to reflecting some sort of risk that these governments are actually a bunch of bust.
Right. Your bond
guys, you shouldn't be lending money to. I mean, okay, the banks aren't 100% exposed on their balance sheet to sovereign debt, but they have quite a good slug. And suddenly you have seen that margin of capital of, say, 4% has gone. It's just gone in bad debt.
Yeah.
To the most unlikely source, government.
Yeah.
So this is a very dangerous situation. And I think the fact that we have these negative interest rates, not only in Japan, but also in Europe, I mean, I think something like 40% of the Eurozone bonds are negative yielding now. You know, obviously, most of that is very, very short term. I mean, this is just a ridiculous situation. It's complete. It's bonkers. It's bizarre.
Alistair, I've got just a couple of questions left in queue. This next one comes from Stephen, who says that in a recent interview, you said that you'd rather be called a sound money bug rather than a gold bug. Can you explain what you mean by this, including what else besides precious metals that you consider to be sound money?
Well, Stephen, it's very simple. Yes, I do believe in sound money, and it's not just a question of belief. If you actually think through economic theory, a reasoned economic theory, it is quite clear that if you corrupt the method with which we account, then obviously you're going to have unexpected and unpleasant consequences. That is the difference between sound money and weak money. So I come at the whole of this question of economics, monetary policy, and all the rest of it as a sound money man. Now, the problem is, what is sound money? It is certainly not something that government produces.
Right.
Sound money is money that has stood the test of time, and that always brings me back to one thing: is gold and silver. Metals, if you like, precious metals, which have been selected by man, in fact, completely independently. I mean, when the Spanish came over to your part of the world and discovered, Incas and all the rest of it, guess what they valued? The same stuff as us. Hello.
How about that?
So this is something which is if you like, it is something that is selected by people, if you like, collectively, the markets, as the best form of arranging for the exchange of the products of our labor.
Right.
So it's as simple as that. It's sound money first, but it just happens the only sound money there actually is gold and secondly silver.
These last two questions, Alistair, have to do really kind of with gold money and the bit-gold combination. The second one directly with that one, the first one somewhat indirectly. So let's start with the first one. With the continued anticipation of a war against gold and silver by the global banking and government institutions, as long as a fiat paper standard exists, regardless of the precious metal price, which geopolitical jurisdiction do you think provides the least amount of risk for the private ownership and storage of precious metal?
It's a good one. To some extent, it depends where you are. I think that the one thing I would say is that it does make sense to store your wealth in a different jurisdiction from the one you live. I'm not saying that you break the law or anything like that, but what I'm saying is that you make things more difficult for the government to grab your money if that's what they seek to do.
Right.
On this whole subject, I can understand there is a huge sensitivity to it in America because of what happened in 1934. The world is actually a very different place nowadays. I think two things. I think if the government turned round and tried to confiscate gold, I think there would be an absolute, I mean, there would be complete riots. The world is very different. I know that Americans are still very patriotic and all the rest of it, but I think when it comes to their money, they're less patriotic than they were in the 1930s. The second thing I would say is that all my researches indicate that both China and Russia have accumulated very, very large stores of gold. The priority, therefore, for the American government when it comes to gold policy is not to introduce policies that are likely to drive up the gold price. Now, I think if any country turned round and said its citizens are no longer, major country I should say, its citizens are no longer allowed to buy gold and they have to submit it to the government, I think that would drive up the gold price very, very sharply. So, because it would be indicative of government panic over the question of gold. So it is actually illogical for them to do that. Now, having said that, when governments get their back up against the wall, they do some very, very stupid things. That's so we can't rule it out entirely. So it does depend where you are. All I would say is select a jurisdiction where property law is as sound as possible.
Yeah.
And basically make sure it's not the jurisdiction in which you live. So I think countries like Switzerland, countries like Singapore are fine. I think that places like, I mean, Canada actually is pretty good because they've got, a far better respect for property rights than it seems the American government has. stealing data and all the rest of it.
Right.
I mean, that to me is property as much as anything else. So you can see that, you've got to think in terms of property in the widest sense, I think. But anyway, there's some ideas. I hope that gives some guidance. I can't answer it specifically because obviously each person's circumstances are different.
But
the one thing that that BitGold does, I mean, particularly BitGold, we've got vaults all around the world through Brinks. So your gold in there is yours. It's physically identifies as yours. It is insured. It is not on BitGold's or Gold Money's balance sheet, and you can use it. You can use it because you have what over here we call a debit card. In other words, you preload the account, and your card gives you access to it.
Yep. Let's use that as a transition to the last question that I have in queue. Sell BitGold a little bit. I try to do it myself on the side. I think it's a wonderful way to save in something that is. I mean, why do you want to continue to save in dollars or euros or yen or anything else that's continually being devalued? And this idea that you eventually here in the States, I'm sure we'll have that debit card as well, but you can save in gold and then use that to purchase things. I think it's wonderful. Eric's question is, he's looking forward to a discussion of BitGold because he's considering putting some cash there and opening an account. And he's, furthermore, he'd like to know if there's any prospect of BitSilver.
let me do the last one first. BitSilver, no, because the storage costs for silver are far greater. I mean, if you think about it, the volume of it is just so much more enormous than with gold. The way I look at this one, Eric, I'll just tell you my own personal view on this. I think BitGold has done one thing which is really quite extraordinary, and that is it's upended Gresham's Law. Now, Gresham's Law was the one, it was a courtier of Queen Elizabeth I back in the 1500s, and Sir Thomas Gresham turned round and said that bad money drives out the good. Now, what he was referring to were clipped coins, as it were. basically what happens is that you get a pocket load of change, you look at the coins that are entire, and you hang on to those, and you pass on the ones that have sort of had bits chipped off them. That's the origin of it. But really what's happened to gold is that gold has been driven out by the bad money, by fiat currency. And what BitGold have managed to do is they've managed to find devise a means of bringing it back into circulation. And I think this is very important because putting my sound money hat on, I really do think that the current fiat currency system is going to end with a crisis. Now, that being the case, each of us as individuals is going to have a means of acceptable payment for the normal things that we use day to day, whether it's food or fuel or clothes or gas or whatever. And if fiat currency has collapsed, what are you going to, how are you going to do this? I mean, the only answer really is something like Bitgold, because you have the technology to have brought gold back in to circulation as money. And I think I'm very, very keen to ensure as much as I can that the authorities look at this as something which, if you like, is a plan B for them rather than a threat to the whole system. We're not a threat to the whole system. If anything, we're giving people the opportunity to survive the mistakes that, unfortunately, central bankers have found out the hard way. So, and I find also from my own personal point of view, to get used to using it. There's some circumstances where it's far cheaper to use, actually, than using the conventional banking system. I mean, for example, if I go over to France and I use my my ordinary sterling debit card or credit card, I find the cost by the time you take the currency conversion from sterling into euros, plus what the card issuer charges, they're taking about 4.5% of my money out of that transaction. With Bitgold, it's 1% in, 1% out. So you can see that immediately I'm saving on, by using it. And if I'm saving by using it, and at the same time my cash balance is going up in value, then surely that's a pretty good deal. And that's roughly what we've got at the moment.
See, very easy to join. I encourage everybody to check it out. I've got some money at Bitgold myself. They're an advertiser, one of our sponsors here on the site. There's a Bitgold ad on the sidebar of every page. Bitgold is actually the sponsor of every podcast that we do as well. There's a Bitgold ad right next to the podcast player button. I just think it's great. And again, anytime I can associate with you, Alistair, Mr. Turk, John Butler, who I think is just a brilliant guy. Like you said, it's fully allocated. The gold is held in storage in different vaults all around the world. I think it's just great. And Alistair, we think you're great, for crying out loud. You've been very generous with your time, and this has just been extraordinarily helpful. And I want to, as we wrap up, remember we always do the final four here with the four quickies. If you're ready, my friend, I'll lay them on you.
Yes, go on.
Okay, number one. Do you own any mining shares?
The answer is no. And I'm rather regretting I didn't buy some of the juniors about 8 weeks ago.
Yeah.
No, I used to be a stockbroker. I love dealing in those things. But basically, I've come out of it now, and I spend all my time really trying to educate people about sound money rather than sitting there and sort of playing the markets.
I got you. I understand. And again, and I've felt that way for a long time too. I've got a few shares now, and they've gone up in the last couple of weeks. But at the end of the day, you just don't know what's going to happen. And I concentrate on physical precious metal, just as you do. Number two, Alistair, over there in London, they got that big old Ferris wheel. You ever ridden that thing?
No. I mean, I think it's very much a sort of, if I was a tourist coming into London, then it's something I would probably do, because, I can imagine how much you can see from the top of it. And it's quite a nice thing to do if you've got the family with you and things like that, particularly if you've got kids. Mm-hmm. But for someone who lives here, I'm sort of, when I hit London, I'm going to meetings or going to lunch or whatever. I don't have time for that, unfortunately.
Fair enough. All right, Alistair, question number three. Who is your favorite Beatle? You a Ringo guy? You a Paul guy? Well, how do you feel about it?
Gosh, oh my goodness me. I don't know. I think I'm probably probably a Lennon guy, really. I mean, not his politics and all that stuff. I mean, it was completely ridiculous. But as a lyricist and songwriter, he was brilliant, absolutely brilliant. I mean, they were all good.
Did you?
There was a sort of touch of genius in there, which I think we have to respect.
No doubt about it. Did you and Mrs. McLeod ever spend like about 2 weeks just laying around in bed, kind of like John and Yoko? No.
No. She keeps on telling me to get out of bed and go and make a cup of tea. It wouldn't work.
All right. And finally, we kind of touched upon this earlier. That gold-silver ratio is just extremes. I've seen a lot of different charts showing it, historic extremes at whatever it is, 80, 82, 83 to 1 this morning. 16 to 1 might be a bit of a stretch. What do you think? What would be a proper gold-silver ratio, do you think?
Well, I mean, without silver being accepted anywhere as money,
right,
then, you know, it can be anywhere between 50 and 100, if you like. I mean, you know, depending on industrial demand. But as soon as it comes back into use as money, then you're back down to somewhere below 30, I would say, with a long-term prospect of it getting down to 20. We're a long way from that. What we would need to see is the destruction of the current monetary system, which, in terms of time, may be only 2 or 3 years away.
Maybe the next time we talk.
Well, I hope not. I mean, I don't want to see all the destruction that appears to me to be increasingly inevitable, because it's all of us that get hurt in this. It really is.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I'm not looking forward to that at all. All I'm looking forward to is the sense that I have at least taken some protection against it, and I can help my family and my, you know, close friends to a degree if things really do cut up rough.
Spoken like a true turdite and honorary member of Turdville right there. Alistair, it's always a pleasure to visit with you, and you've been extremely valuable with your time today, and it's been just tremendously insightful. And I think this is something, this particular podcast will be something people go back and listen to a couple times over. I know we're going to have to speak again soon. We'll be watching developments here as we head through the springtime, waiting toward the end of June. And we'll certainly talk before that. But I want to thank you again for your time today, and wish you a great rest of your Thursday. And hey, it's cocktail hour. It's about 6 o'clock London time. Time for you to go grab a martini or something, isn't it?
I think so. I think it's probably a whiskey on the rocks. I think it's probably my preferred one. But it has been very, very much my pleasure, and I always enjoy these sessions.
All right, my friend. Have a great rest of your day.
Thank you. And you and everybody in Turdville.